Afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Chip Schoenberger. My registration number is 41922, and I represent the law firm of Foster Graham Milstein and Kalischer in this appeal. I understand Mr. McNamara won't be present today. I think he's feeling ill, so I'll be the only one arguing for our side today. This case comes before the court on a attorney's fees order entered against the Foster Graham law firm and its client, Mr. Kelly, with respect to a breach of lease claim that it maintained against the defendant, which the trial court found to be frivolous. Your Honors, in a case called Pedlow versus Stamm, Justice Judge Dubofsky wrote, "There are compelling reasons to allow the liberal assertion of new and different legal theories and claims based on them. Courts should welcome, not decry, proposed new directions in the law. The first attorney to challenge Plessy versus Ferguson was certainly bringing a frivolous action, but his efforts and the efforts of others led to Brown v. Board of Education." Now, I read those comments not because the Pedlow case applies to this case, but to illustrate how we as a legal society encourage and we applaud zealous advocacy that results in evolution of the law. The law is a constantly evolving body of work. And so, fortunately, this case doesn't ask the court to decide any new legal theories. It simply asks the court to decide whether or not a rational basis existed to believe that Mr. Kelly could maintain a breach of lease claim against the defendant under a holdover tenancy theory. And our legal arguments as to that issue specifically are outlined in the brief, and I'm not going to rehash them here, but I will summarize it like this. The trial court read the first Interstate versus Tank Tech case to require an express assignment of the lease in order to maintain a breach of lease claim under a holdover tenancy theory. And the language of that case, the Supreme Court's language, is not that narrow. The Supreme Court expressly said that while an assignment will do the trick, it also applies to original parties to the lease and their grantees. And the record is clear in this case that Mr. Kelly was a grantee of the original owner of the property, Mr. Salmon. And therefore, it's rational to believe under the express language, the Supreme Court's express language, that a holdover tenancy theory could be advanced under those circumstances. Now, I'd like to just touch on a couple of fact issues that were raised in the briefs, just to clear up the facts in the record. First of all, with respect to whether a lease existed, I personally don't know what a letter understanding is, but I do know that in the record at page 68 and page 70, there are two letters, and one is from Mr. Schuyler to Mr. Salmon, the prior owner, explaining that here's my $12,000 roughly for rent for the upcoming year at a little over $1,000 a month. And it goes on to say all other lease terms and conditions will remain the same as last year. A few years later, we have a letter from January 2006 from Mr. Schuyler to Mr. Kelly, the new owner of the property. As I explained to you, I explained to you that my firm's previous arrangement with Mr. Salmon was that it had a year-to-year lease with him, which was paid in advance at year-end for the next year for tax purposes. So there's certainly evidence in the record that a lease existed.
And pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Schoenberger, but the trial court didn't dispute that, did it?
The trial court didn't dispute the existence of the letters, and in fact, the trial court found that there was a reasonable basis to believe that a lease existed. What the trial court said was there's no assignment, which it believed was necessary under the Colorado Supreme Court case, and that there were no estoppel certificates, and that there wasn't a formal lease between Mr. Kelly and Mr. Schuyler. Our theory, as the court knows, is that Mr. Kelly was a successor in interest to the 2004 lease when he bought the property during the term of that lease, and then the holdover tenancy period kicked in after that, under which the terms of that lease were carried over in successive years until the lawsuit was filed.
I'm missing a beat here. Did the trial court believe that Mr. Schuler could stay there indefinitely without paying rent?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I don't think the trial court really weighed in on that. There was a trial that happened, you know, a year and a half later or so. But as to the issues raised in this appeal, the court really didn't express an opinion on that. It simply said, in a breach of lease context under the holdover tenancy doctrine, where a subsequent owner of the property is asserting the claim, you have to have a written assignment.
And if you don't, then your tenants can just sit there indefinitely without paying rent?
Apparently so, unless some other form of lease is established, which, you know, isn't our fact situation, so.
So the FED was filed, but then the gentleman moved out and mooted it?
Yeah, vacated the property, and there were alternate claims for breach of lease and unjust enrichment because there were some vagaries with respect to what was really going on here.
All right, thank you.
So I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal and ask that the court reverse the attorney's fees award.
Thank you, counsel. You have about 9 minutes remaining.
Thank you.
It pleases the court, Michael Schuyler on behalf of the law offices of Michael Schuyler, registration number 15228. The issue in this case is, as Mr. Schoenberger indicated, is whether or not the trial court erred in making a determination that my firm was entitled to an award of attorney's fees and costs with regard to the breach of lease claim that had been brought against my firm. I think it is important to establish the factual background in this case in order to have a clear understanding as to exactly what occurred. My firm did move into the Solomon Law Building in approximately 2001. Starting in 2001 and each year thereafter, I had a letter understanding with the Solomon Law Firm that I would basically be there for 1 year. I don't dispute whether or not that is a lease, a letter understanding, or what exactly it was for purposes of the determination that was made by the trial court with respect to the award of attorney's fees and costs.
Mr. Schuyler, are you saying now that the letter understanding was a lease or was the equivalent to a lease? Because I think that's different from what you stated in your brief.
I'm not saying it's a lease, but I don't think it's relevant to the issues that are necessary to determine for purposes of why the trial court awarded the attorney's fees. And I don't think that the trial court made a determination as to whether or not those letters established a lease or not. So for purposes of this argument, no, I'm not conceding that it's a lease. Again, from my perspective, they were letter understandings.
Well, what's the difference between a lease and a letter understanding? I'm not sure I understand that.
Again, I'm not for sure that there is a difference, but again, for purposes of why the issue that's before the court today, I don't think it is important. And if I could, I'll try to explain that and sort of where the trial court came to this understanding with regard to whether or not it's a lease or a letter understanding. So each year I entered into a letter understanding. Same thing on around January 1st of 2004. There was a letter understanding with the Solomon Law Firm. During the summer of 2004, the building was put up for sale because John Solomon, the owner, who was also an attorney, was on a disability disactive status. And in fact, through his conservatorship, the law firm the building got put up for sale. During the summer of 2004, my law firm, as well as three other occupants of the building, were approached about signing an estoppel certificate in going forward with the purchase of the building by Mr. Kelly. I refused to sign that estoppel certificate because at the time I didn't believe I had a lease. And if there was a lease, based on the letter understandings, they had been already violated. So I did not sign an estoppel certificate that summer.
But wouldn't that have, assuming your You didn't, and you didn't have to. Wouldn't that simply have taken your lease to 2005, at which point you would be unpaid?
No. And the reason that I believe that, again, is because they were for specific terms. And starting January 1st, 2001 through December 31st, 2001, that was my letter of understanding for that.
Okay, what was your last letter of understanding with Mr. Salmon, the dates?
January 1st, 2004
right.
through December 31st, 2004.
Okay, so on December 31st, 2004, your lease ended and you were no longer paid up.
Correct.
Now, how is it possible that you were able to stay there 3 more years without paying if you did, if I understand the facts right?
Yes, you do understand the
how
facts.
How is that possible?
Okay. The way it was possible is that subsequent to, in the fall of 2004, Mr. Kelly purchased the property. Immediately following his purchase of the property, I approached Mr. Kelly on 2 occasions before year end in order to come to a new lease or some type of a lease understanding with him. This was important to me because the arrangement that I had with the Salmon firm, the big part of the consideration was that my legal research was being paid through LexisNexis at the time, and they had the Cadillac policy, and it was a big part of my consideration. So I approached Mr. Kelly about entering into a new lease with my firm in late 2004 on a couple of occasions. He said that he would get back with me as well as all of the other occupants of the building. He didn't get back to me. In early 2005, I again contacted him with no response, so then I began to contact his real estate agent with no response. That whole calendar year went by with no communication from Mr. Kelly to my firm about a new lease. And at the end of 2005, roughly in late December sometime, Mr. Kelly sent a letter to my firm as well as to all of the other occupants in the building saying, please pay me for 2005. Myself, as well as the other occupants in the building, wrote a letter back to Mr. Kelly saying, hey, look, we talked to you in late 2004 about this. We're more than happy to enter into a lease with respect to our occupation of the building. Suggest something, get in touch with us, anything we're willing to go for. It's all part of the record, that letter. And so that was at the end of 2005. So from the end of 2005, through 2009, Mr. Kelly was attempting to sell the building. He was communicating not with the occupants of the building, but rather with potential purchasers or the real estate agents that the way that he was going to deal with the rent was by virtue of the potential purchasers could deal with the occupants of the building with regard to rent issues. And subsequently,
these 3 years went by with no payment of rent.
None.
And surely you understood as an intelligent person, a lawyer, that you owed rent.
Yes.
You don't deny you owed 3 years of rent.
Well, it's a very complicated issue from the standpoint, but what I will let you know is that the three claims that were initially brought were an unlawful detainer claim, a breach of lease claim, and an unjust enrichment claim.
That wasn't my question. My question was, you understood that you owed 3 years worth of rent.
Well, actually, I didn't believe that.
You thought you could stay there free?
I thought that given the circumstances surrounding the occupation of the building that where my firm, as well as the other occupants, we basically had a landlord abandon the building. We did our own maintenance on the building. We did our both interior and exterior for a period of time. A number of our services were lost. And I understand your concerns, and that's why an unjust enrichment claim went forward in the trial court for Mr. Kelly to have an opportunity to try to collect some portion of rent for the 4.5 years that we were in the building. During that 4.5 year period, it went to a 2-day trial to the court in front of Judge Hannon 2 Novembers ago, and Mr. Kelly lost that claim. and the court made a determination that my firm was not unjustly enriched over that period of time and that I owed no rent. With regard to the award of attorney's fees, again, I think the record fully supports the award based upon the factual situation that existed. And again, I think that in brief form, it's been set forth in the briefs, but the argument initially was that Mr. Kelly was a successor in interest. During discovery and depositions for over a year, he maintained that he had gotten written assignments from my firm, as well as from other occupants of the building, as well as written estoppel certificates. That ended up not being true.
Mr. Schuyler, even if that wasn't correct, what is your response to your opposing counsel's point that the Tank Tech case refers to either an assignment or a grantee being able to assert an interest?
I think that I do not believe that Judge Cross at the time made that a specific condition of his ruling. And I think that in reading through the Tank Tech case, it is very important to look at the entire language of that particular case with regard to the issues are that the holdover term must be successive on the same premises as the original lease and between the landlord and tenant who entered into the lease or a grantee or assignee of either of the original parties. I think that the word grantee is not used in terms of a grantee of a deed, but rather a grantee of the lease. And if you read through the entire Colorado Supreme Court case, with respect to the Tank Tech case, I think that it becomes clear that it must be a situation where the terms of the lease must be between the original parties. If not, there either has to be a subsequent agreement between the parties, which did not happen in our case, or that the holdover tenancy is not applicable, and that's what Judge Cross ruled.
So, I'm sorry.
Is there an alternative to an assignment that would make someone a grantee, in your view? Or do you think the Supreme Court was using those terms interchangeably?
I think the Supreme Court, based upon the entire discussion in that case, I think the court was using the words interchangeably.
Okay, thank you.
Well, yeah, having read Tank Tech very recently, my concern is that it appears to me that the court there was very interested in the language that it chose. And it didn't just say assignee, it said grantee or assignee. And there's no indication to me in that case that they only intended that language to apply to the lessee. It said parties, plural. Tell me why I'm wrong.
I think in reading through the entire context of the Tank case as I have read it, it says it only is applicable to when it is in a situation between the original parties to the original lease or a new agreement. That is not what we had in this particular case.
So your position is when Mr. Salmon sold it to Mr. Kelly, Mr. Salmon retained the only rights to enforce the lease even though he was gone?
Well, again, the lease that he had was for 2004, for 2004.
And it ended?
And it ended, but when Mr. Kelly bought the property, it was prorated out on Mr. Kelly's settlement sheet that he got October, November, and December for that particular year. Going forward, no, I do not believe that he was a successor in interest with respect to a lease right.
So your position is no one could enforce the lease?
There was no
after lease. The 2004, you could stay in the building indefinitely and no one had standing to enforce the lease?
There was no lease.
Right, but let's say at that point you were there, correct?
Yes.
You were acting as a tenant? You were using the property, he owned it?
Yes.
What right did you have to be there?
Again...
Under what authority, in other words, if you're not there under the lease, what authority do you have to remain on someone else's property?
We were just occupants of the building, attempting to negotiate...
Isn't that the exact definition of a holdover tenant?
I understand your point with regard to holdover tenancy, but that doctrine in Colorado, as it is applied in this particular case, is not applicable, nor is the law that has been asserted by Mr. Kelly in support of it.
Judge Crisscross entered the fees, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
One last question, Mr. Schuyler. If after 2004 had ended, if Mr. Kelly had walked into your office and said, please leave, and please leave now, would you have been required to go?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's all my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have one quick point, Your Honor. Mr. Schuyler stated he didn't believe that the trial court rested its decision on a reading of Tank Tech, and I have the transcript right here, where the court says, it's obvious that the landlord and tenant were not the same, so the only basis that the plaintiffs could have the holdover tenancy doctrine to apply is if there was an assignment from Mr. Selman to Mr. Kelly, and there simply was none. That's the crux of the case. That's where the court erred. And we ask that that Your Honors reverse that decision.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenberger. Counsel, thank you very much for coming today. We appreciate your arguments very much, and we appreciate your time. Please go safely home. Case shall stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. This is the end of our docket for the afternoon, and the bailiff may announce the recess, please.